Welcome to the Human and Technology Podcast. This podcast is for anyone who develops, distributes, or uses technology. For all those who always have the feeling that technology overwhelms or dominates them. For everyone who wants to know how to deal with technology in everyday life. For anyone who wants to understand what technology does to us and how we can get our lives back. This podcast is for those who want to make technology sexy. All the product developers, designers, UX, UI professionals, product managers, CTOs, and CEOs. And it is for you. My name is Dr. Peter Ryska. My friends call me Dr. Peter. I am your host, and I am happy that you are here. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Human Technology Podcast. Today, I want to talk about the revenge of the analog. I have done an episode some like a year and a half, 2 years ago on a similar focus. But since particularly in the automotive industry, there is a shift, there's a change in thinking and acting, I found it worthwhile on making another one on exactly this issue. And I'm talking about the revenge of the analog in all of my keynotes. So if you want to get deeper into this, if you want to have more insights, if you want to hear it live on stage, don't hesitate to contact me and hire me for an appearance on one of your events. All right, so that was the commercial block for today. Let's get into it. Let's get into what is called the revenge of the analog, or sometimes not that harsh, the return of the analog. For decades, we have been told the same story over and over again. The future is digital. Basically meaning more displays, more automation, more software, faster, smarter, more efficient. And for a long time, this story seemed to be, at least to a large extent, true. Something is changing. Across industries, across products, in our everyday lives, we are observing a quiet but powerful shift. Printed books are holding their ground against their e-readers. Vinyl records are making a comeback in the age of streaming. People are rediscovering handwriting, pen and paper. We're using more physical controls, real tangible interactions. What long seemed like nostalgia is increasingly developing into, let's call it, a broader movement. The Revenge of the Analog by David Sachs, a beautiful book you should read. In this book, describe this phenomenon pretty early. What we are seeing today goes beyond what David Sachs was writing about. It is not a niche occurrence. It's not a short-term counter trend. But from my point of view, it is a corrective movement. Because while technology has evolved at a rapid pace, humans have remained fundamentally the same. Our brains, our perception, our way of interacting, they are the result of millions of years of evolution. Industrialization has shaped us for about 200 years, and the digital world has existed for less than 50 years. And yet we are often designing interfaces as if humans were created for screens. And we are not. We are not designed to interact with pieces of glass with some flickering, flimmering screen behind it. And the revenge of the analog is the moment when this contradiction becomes visible, when humans, consciously or unconsciously, begin to resist purely digital interactions. When we start demanding experiences that feel natural, intuitive, and human. This has profound consequences for the design of technology, and especially for the design of human-machine interfaces, of HMIs. In today's episode of the Human Technology Podcast, I will focus on three topics. I will dive into three topics. Number one, humans as analog beings, while 100% digital does not work. So a bit about the psychological, anthropological, evolutionary background. The second part will be about examples from David Sacks' book, The Revenge of the Analog, and what they mean to us. And number three will be on how this topic impacts the automotive industry. So let's start with humans as analog beings. When we talk about the revenge of the analog, we need to take a step back. Not back to technology, but back to humans. The crucial point is simple and surprisingly often ignored. Humans are not digital beings. We are analog beings. We have analog senses. We react on analog signals from our environment. And HMIs basically are translators between the digital world of software, of technology, of hardware, of AI, whatever, on one side, and the analog human senses on the other side. And this translation goes two ways. It translates the results of the digital calculations into something we can see, feel, hear. And whatever we do, when we touch something, when we talk, when we interact with technology, then these actions that humans perform are translated into digital signals. And this is the role of an HMI. The way we think, we feel, and act as the result of an extremely long evolutionary process. So I believe in the scientific mainstream that something like 4.5 billion years ago, life came into existence into whatever way. However that happened, we will probably never know how really the very first steps were. And since then, we have some kind of evolution that living beings have small changes in their genome, and if this is bad, it will be not be selected, it will be wiped out of the gene pool. And if a genetic change is either good or at least not negative, then it will remain. This is what I believe in. I know that there are different views on this one, but this is the basis of my thinking. Over millions of years, our cognitive abilities, our perception, our interaction patterns developed in a world that was completely analog. A world of physical objects, direct social exchange, multi-sensory impressions, and immediate direct analog feedback. We are designed to communicate with other humans. For about 70,000 years, which was 70,000 years ago, human brains gained in complexity and we learned to use speech, language, to interact with words on the level we are doing it until today. And so in the past 70,000 years, we have basically been sitting most of the time sitting around campfires with a few peers exchanging ideas. We hunted and gathered in small groups and in constant direct interaction. And this kind of communication, that is what we are evolutionarily optimized for. This is the communication. And this communication is anything but digital. It's multimodal, it's context dependent, it's physical, it's emotional. At a glance, a ton of voice, small gesture, all of these convey information that goes far beyond what can be translated into explicit, formalized signals. And this is exactly where the fundamental break with the digital world lies. Digital systems reduce complexity. They have to. They translate reality into data, into states, into clearly defined interactions. A button is pressed or not pressed. A menu item is selected or not selected. This logic is efficient for machines. But it's not natural for humans. And the result is cognitive effort. Whenever we interact with digital interfaces, we have to translate. We need to understand how a system thinks, how it is organized, how is it structured, what option does it offer, and what consequences will our inputs have. We adapt to the logic of the machine and not the other way around. My main statement, one of my main statements is, we need to know everything about humans when we design technology, not vice versa. We need to know everything about humans when we design technology, not vice versa. It takes a moment to think about it, but do it. And this is exactly what we call cognitive load. This is where it comes from. The additional mental burden is not a bug. It's a direct consequence of the fact that digital interaction does not match our natural way of dealing with the world. While we grasp many things in the physical world implicitly, intuitively, and almost automatically, the digital world often forces us into explicit decisions and conscious actions. And this would not be a problem if we had unlimited cognitive resources. But we don't. We do not have unlimited cognitive resources. Our brain is a masterpiece of efficiency, but precisely because of that, it is limited. It works with heuristics, simplifications, and experience. It is designed to conserve energy, to save energy, and to react quickly. Every additional cognitive demand, every unnecessary decision, every non-intuitive interaction consumes additional energy. And that energy is then missing somewhere else. When we design interfaces today that primarily, first of all, rely on visual, abstract, and sequential interaction, as it is the case with most of the digital systems, we are working against human nature. The temporal dimensions makes this mismatch even clearer. The Industrial Revolution, I talked about this, yeah, the Industrial Revolution began shaping humans about 200 years ago. So machines replaced physical work and reorganized work. Yeah? Work processes became structured, standardized, and optimized. And although 200 years to some of us may sound like a long time, in the evolutionary process, it's just the blink of an eye. It's just a millisecond of something. Yeah? So we are not adapted to that. And even worse, the digital revolution is even younger. For less than 50 years, it has shaped our daily lives. Wherever we are, touchscreens, apps, software-based interfaces, all this is more or less new from an evolutionary perspective. It is absolutely new from an evolutionary perspective. No, we are made for the times that we had 10,000 years ago. There were no digital, no software-based interfaces. It was all fully analog. And 4 billion years of times took us there in the evolution. And now in the past 200 years, we have introduced machines. In the past less than 50 years, we have introduced digital interactions. And today, we often act as if humans have already fully adopted to it. And of course, humans are super flexible. We can learn, we can adapt. This is not the question. The question is, are we fully adapted to a fully digital world? And for me, the opposite is true. What we are currently experiencing is not a complete transition into a digital world. It's a phase of overreaction, overcorrection, a phase in which technological possibilities dominate design and humans have to adapt. And now we come back to the major point. The revenge of the analog is the counter movement to this. And this is not a step backward. It is not a romantic look into the past. It is a signal. An interaction that's successful, an indication that, yeah, successful interaction always emerges where technology adapts to humans and not the other way around. Or to put it differently, we design interfaces for machine logic, but they're used by humans. And this contradiction becomes visible, and with that, it is beginning to dissolve. Let's move on to part number two, the book of David Saxon. I recommend that if you have a chance to read it, read it. It's definitely worth working yourself into it and then reading it. Analog is not a step backward. Analog is a human advantage. When we talk about the revenge of the analog, we inevitably arrive at the observations of David Sacks and his book, The Revenge of the Analog. Anyone expecting just a collection of nostalgic examples is missing the point here. The book is not about people suddenly wanting to go back. It is about people beginning to choose more consciously. And this choice, surprisingly, often favors analog experiences. A classic example is the return of the vinyl records. In 2022, more vinyl records were sold than CDs, and was for the first time since the late 1980s. Most of the music was streamed, let's keep that out. If we take a physical carrier of music in 2022, for the first time after the late 80s, more analog devices, more vinyl records were sold than digital devices, which is the compact disc. And from a purely rational perspective, this doesn't make any sense at all. Yeah, CDs are more practical. Streaming looks even more efficient. It's cheaper. It's more accessible. It's more convenient. But the vinyl record market, particularly in the US, has been growing for years. Why is this? Because vinyl records offer something that streaming cannot deliver. It's a physical experience, it's a ritual, a conscious decision to engage with music. A few months ago, I was in a hotel, and in the hotel bar, there was a little collection of vinyl records and a record player. And there was a sign, feel free to use it if you want to. And I went there and I flipped through the vinyl records, I pulled one out, then I pulled it out of the outer sleeve, then I put it out of the inner sleeve, I put it onto the turntable, put the needle onto the vinyl record. That was a little crackling here, and then there was music. Yeah, this was an experience. First of all, it took me back into the early 80s when I was in my early 20s. Yeah, and this was the thing that really, really triggered me. Yeah, it created a quality of experience that goes far beyond sheer consumption. Pretty much the same applies to physical bookstores. Yeah, despite the dominance of online platforms and ebook readers, people still go to bookstores. Not because it's more efficient, but because it feels different. And I really love bookstores. And to be honest, I feel pretty bad because I'm using an ebook reader just for practical reasons. But I love bookstores. So I'm a little torn apart here between these two things I'm doing, buying all my things online, all my books online, and then reading them on an ebook reader. And on the other side, I love to go to bookstores. And little footnote here, for me, it would be a great business model to go to a bookstore, run through the books, flip it here, flip it there, read a bit into it, and then go to the cashier and say, I want to have this book on my ebook reader. And I would pay an additional 1, 2, 3 euros just for the service to mix it. But even me as an ebook reader, as a person using ebook readers, I love physical bookstores. Yeah, because they provide context. It allows me discovery. And it is somehow social. There are always cool people, little strange people in bookstores. Paper notebooks. Yeah, writing on paper. And that is something I'm doing very consequently. I'm writing on paper. Of course, when I'm at a conference, when I take note or in meetings, I could use my MacBook. I could use my iPhone to put down things. But I have a paper notebook, and I have a beautiful pen. I have a set of pens, and one is a very, very nice Porsche design a pen that I'm using for writing. I also have a red one for correcting the exams of my students, and I'm having one to make sketches. So those are the three ones I'm always carrying with me, plus my paper notebook. And writing by hand makes it easier to learn things, at least for old people like me. So I learn better when I write something by hand, when I sketch ideas, and when I structure thoughts in this analog way. And there are studies out there that show that I'm not the only one that learns better with handwriting. There are more examples about this one. In northern Italy, two entrepreneurs, I would call them two crazy guys, they revived the production of celluloid films. In the old times, movies were filmed on celluloid and they needed to pre-produce. And then in northern Italy, there was a production place for this kind of film. And they acquired this production place and they re-engineered the entire process. They needed to find out how did they do it, because nobody knows anymore how to produce a celluloid film. And they found out where and how to get all the chemicals that you need to do this. And they revitalized this. They're producing this one at a time when digital cameras dominate and film was considered obsolete. They consciously invest in a seemingly outdated medium. And the crazy thing is, directors from Hollywood, movie makers, cinematographers, creatives, they see and feel the difference. They are requesting this celluloid film. And because celluloid forces a different way of working. It requires more planning, more precision, more awareness of the moment. So every take counts. You cannot overwrite a celluloid film. You can do this with a digital media. Yeah, but you cannot override a celluloid film. So every scene, every shot that you do has a weight. And the result is different. If you have a look at it, it looks different. And it is a different creative process. So the technology, the way you record pictures, moving pictures, creates or requires a different creative process depending on the technology that you use. So the analog does not only change the product, it changes the thinking, the acting, the entire process. Mechanical wristwatches. Yeah, in a world where every smartphone tells the time more precisely, more cheaply, and with more features, they seem irrational at the first glance. And yet all watches are costing tens of thousands of euros if you have a Rolex or if you have any of the high-end brands. And they're selling extremely well. Because they're much more than timekeepers. A mechanical watch is a visible technology. Gears, springs, energy transfer, a complex system that is entirely comprehensible. You can see it, you can understand it, you can experience it. It's craftsmanship, engineering, and aesthetics in one. And above all, it conveys a sense of control, stability, and value. A smartwatch shows time as a function. A mechanical watch shows time as an experience. And all these examples, they follow a common pattern. Analog is not better in the classical sense of efficiency, speed, or scalability. Analog is often superior when it comes to quality of experience, trust and control, physicality and sensuality, focus and attention, meaning and value. Digital systems optimized for efficiency. Analog systems optimized for experience. And this is where the shift begins. What David Sacks describes is ultimately a change in the perspective, away from the question, what is technologically possible, towards the question, what makes sense for humans? And this is one of my basic mantras when I give my keynotes, when I work with my clients on technological projects. Does it really make sense? Does this feature make the world a better place? Yes or no? If yes, let's go for it. If no, drop it. And this shift is crucial because for a long time, digitalization was treated as an end in itself. Everything that could be digitized was digitized. Processes were automated, interface abstracted, interactions dematerialized, and something was lost. Not functionally, but humanly. And this takes us to the point of control. Digital systems are often black boxes. They make decisions, they process data, they change states, often without the user being able to fully understand what is happening in the background. This creates uncertainty, and uncertainty creates distrust. Analog interaction is radically different in this aspect. A physical switch has a clear stage, a rotary knob provides resistance, a mechanical movement is visible, comprehensible, tangible. Cause and effect, reason and result are closely linked. And this creates trust. Analog does not force efficiency. It allows meaning. And this is where the real revenge lies. Not in turning back, but the return of the human as a benchmark. And all the examples from the revenge of the analog, they make one thing more than clear. Whenever digital solutions ignore fundamental human needs, space emerges for analog alternatives. Or to bring it down to the point, analog does not win because it's technologically superior, but because it's human compatible. And this insight is the key to everything that follows. Let's move on to automotive HMIs. Few industries have implemented digital transformation as consistently and consequently, in some cases as radically, as the automotive industry. For many years, we had a simple paradigm. More displays mean more innovation, more touch means more modernity, and fewer physical controls mean more future. We all know the results. Vehicles are more and more larger screens. They have all centralized HMI concepts. We see in many cars the almost complete shift of interaction to touch interfaces. So at the end of the day, the interior became a tablet on wheels. And the stellar development was neither a coincidence nor an accident. Touchscreens are extremely attractive from a manufacturer's point of view. They are flexible. They can be updated. Now you can put different designs. You can put updates into devices, into touchscreen devices. They reduce hardware complexity. They can be scaled and differentiated via software. And this is probably one of the strongest points if we have a look at touchscreens in cars. They are cheaper than mechanical components. They perfectly fit into the logic of digitalization. And they have one crucial disadvantage. They do not fit the logic of us as humans. Because touch is, contrary to widespread belief, it is not a natural form of interaction. Touch is visual, touch is flat. Touch offers little, almost no haptic feedback. And most importantly, touch forces conscious attention. And in a vehicle, this is exactly the problem. It's not a problem if you have a tablet or your smartphone and you sit at home on your sofa. But in a vehicle, yeah, this distraction is exactly the problem. Driving is a highly dynamic, safety-critical activity. And every additional visual interaction means distraction. And every glance at the screen is missing on the road. And what we see is the classic conflict. Technical and technological elegance versus human suitability. Or system logic versus user context. And this is exactly where the revenge of the analog comes into play. For some time now, we've been observing a counter-movement. Manufacturers are starting to bring back physical controls. Rotary knobs for volumes, buttons for climate functions, for air conditions, haptic switches for core functions. Why do they do this? Because they recognize that certain interactions must be operable without looking at. OEMs realize that haptic feedback is not just comfort, it is safety. And OEMs start to understand that not every function should disappear somewhere deeply buried in a menu. And this is more than a design trend. This is a paradigm shift. The realization at the end is touch was never the final solution. It was just the easiest and the cheapest one. And get me right, the future is not either or. It's not fully analog or not fully digital. It's the orchestration of the interaction. There is a sweet spot between, and touchscreens and cars have strong advantages. And we need to use that. And with the enormous number of functions we have in the car, with all this digital connectivity we have in cars, we need something like a central device which can be a touchscreen. But for certain functions, and this is the revenge of the analog, that's what we learn, we need physical devices. With the consequence that visual interfaces where information is complex. Yeah, that's where we use them. Haptic interfaces is something we need where speed and safety are critical. Voice interaction is used where hands and eyes are occupied. And context-based systems that understand which interaction makes sense when we have this complex interaction on the road with driver distraction. So in other words, the future is multimodal. The future is situational. And first of all, the future is human-centered. And this is the circle closes with the revenge of the analog, because what we are currently seeing in the automotive domain is nothing less than the return to a principle that should have never been lost. Technology must adapt to humans, not vice versa. For the design of automotive HMI, this leads to a clear conclusion. For those who think about interfaces purely from a technological perspective, will fail. Those who think about interfaces from a human-centered perspective will succeed. Even more down to the point, anyone who still believes that everything can be solved with a touchscreen has not understood humans. And that is exactly why a new phase of HMI development is beginning, a phase in which technology is no longer at the center, but the human is. A couple of final words to summarize this episode. The revenge of the analog is not a nostalgic look backward. It is a clear signal. A signal that humans are not infinitely malleable. That our perception, thinking, and interaction do not change at the same pace as technology. And above all, successful products always emerge where technology adapts to humans, not vice versa. The examples from various domains show a consistent pattern. Humans remain analog beings. Digital solutions reach limits when they ignore human needs. Analog elements gain importance where experience, trust, and control matter. The future is therefore not fully digital, it is hybrid. It is somewhere in the sweet spot between analog and digital. For the design of human-machine interfaces, especially in the automotive context, this means a clear direction. It is no longer about digitizing as much as possible. It is about combining the right things. The challenge of the future is not technology. The challenge is orchestration. The search for the sweet spot. And those who understand when a physical control is better than a touchscreen, when voice is more effective than a menu, when less interaction creates more impact, they will design interfaces that do not only work, but feel right, and they are successful. In the end, perhaps the most important insight is the simplest. The future does not belong to those who build the most technology, but to those who understand humans best. That's it for today. Thank you for spending time with me. I hope you were able to take something with you and do something for yourself that will be forever. For an ongoing exchange, you will find me on LinkedIn and on my websites, beta-rusker.com and beyond-hmi.de. Write me an email on the podcast at beyond-hmi.de. Tune in next time, take care, and stay healthy.